war, colonialism, and occupation. It's happening in Iraq, but it's also happening here in Canada. To assess the links between the occupation of Iraq and the occupation of Turtle Island, we spoke with two prominent Indigenous activists. Clifton Nicholas is a resident of Kanasatake, a Mohawk community just to the north of Montreal, which faces imminent invasion at the hands of the RCMP. And Arthur Manuel, who is an activist in Kamloops, BC, and has been very active in the campaign to stop the Sun Peaks Resort. On the line with us right now, we have Clifton, who is joining us from Kanasatake, just outside of Montreal, and Arthur Manuel, who is joining us from Kamloops, British Columbia. Welcome, both of you, to the program.
Hey.
So today we're talking about, the war in Iraq and the invasion of Iraq, but also looking at the occupation here at home with regards to native lands. So maybe to start off, Clifton, I wanted to ask you, maybe you could speak a bit to what occupation and Canadian militarism looks like in Kanasatake today.
Well, today it's like they're attempting to do a lot of different things in this community. One thing they're trying to do, like they're doing in Iraq, is to demonize the population of Kanasatake by using their half-baked drug war. And their whole idea of criminality in the media to demonize the population over here. And they're not telling the whole story of why these police forces and the governments are trying to conduct evil business in this community with their police forces and their military. And, the sad part about it is that the public is buying it up to a certain extent, like they're doing in Iraq with trying to nail terrorism on that country. By saying that these people are responsible for different terrorist actions, which are not really the reason why they're going into that country. You know, we all know it's about resources, and the same thing applies here in Kanasatake. You know, there's the demonization of the population, the attempts to control them with military force and police forces to get at certain resources and certain properties that they can extend their tourist industry and their mining industry in this community.
And speaking of resources, of course, British Columbia, the land out there, is also very resource-rich. Arthur, maybe you could speak a bit to what the occupation of Indigenous lands looks like in British Columbia.
Well, I think one of the things is clear is that Indigenous people are out here in British Columbia have a very clearly recognized judicial and constitutionally protected right to the land. The problem is that the federal government's policy regarding recognition of that does not exist. And so basically there's a failure in the policy of the government to recognize what is judicially recognized. And there's a conflict between the government and the courts on this issue. And because of that, when Indian people get out on the land to occupy and assert their rights, the government resorts to the use of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And if necessary, they would resort to the use of the Army in order to make up for the fact that they don't have policies that work, you know. They seek a police and a military solution instead of seeking a mutually agreeable policy solution.
Clifton, you had kind of mentioned the way in which the Canadian media has been putting the spin on the invasion of Kanasatake. And it's interesting that in Iraq, the American invasion was legitimized as being needed to preserve order and democracy. Do you see any similarities with Kanasatake?
Well, definitely. They're using these high-powered PR firms to spin a story because they learned a lesson from 1990. When they did 1990, during the crisis of 1990, they didn't pick up on their public relations schemes until a couple of days into the crisis. What's different about what happened January 12th is that the PR firms were on it even before the thing happened. So they were waiting. Getting to the whole question of democracy and so on, in order. In Iraq, they were saying the same thing. They're going to restore order and they're going to restore democracy. But what I find very ironic is that at the moment that we're speaking right now, the Canadian government is having their campaign for their elections for the prime minister's seat. Yet in Kanasadaga, we're being prevented from carrying out our elections. This comes from the same people who are trying to pull themselves off as the defenders of democracy. Yet they're stymieing our ability here in Kanasadaga to exercise our rights to democratic process to determine who we want as a leader in a community and who we want to represent this community. And I find it really, really similar to what's going on in Iraq, where they're imposing a government and they're only opposing the elections when they see fit, when it suits their agenda. And obviously what's going on in Kanasadaga, like in Iraq, does not suit their agenda. And I don't believe we're out of the woods for any time soon. There's something at play here that's bigger than what I can come up with at the moment. But you can mark my words, I'll find out what it is, and I'll let you know.
How do you feel that the Canadian government legitimizes their move to occupy Indigenous lands, whether it is in Kanasatake or anywhere else in the country?
Well, I feel pretty pretty upset about it. You know, it's something that strikes deep at the core of my being. You know, what's happening in Indigenous country. You know, I was involved in 1990, in the crisis of 1990. I was a young man at 18 years old, and my eyes were really open to what happened in 1990. And, you know, it's just a continuation of the same old cavalry coming again and again to destroy Indigenous culture and Indigenous people. And, you know, there's one thing that strikes me as very, very odd, is that from 1990, so many other Indigenous communities benefited from what happened in this community. Yet Kanasadaga is still in the same turmoil it was in 1990. You know, nothing has been settled, although they try to make you believe that things were settled, that lands were bought and so on. But that's not even what happened. Now they're trying to enforce municipalization on the community. You know, they're trying to eliminate Indigenous people from the demographic in Canada, eliminate them through legislation, and if that doesn't work, they'll eliminate them through force of arms.
And Arthur, in British Columbia, throughout the course of the last decade, there have been a few good examples of Indigenous resistance to what we could call Canadian colonialism. How have you felt that the media or the government has legitimized what has happened, let's say, at Gustafson Lake or more recently with the Sun Peaks Resort?
Well, I think one of the things is that the media is under, a very serious compromise, you know, in terms of its reporting on Indigenous issues, simply because the government orchestrates the media through using laws that do not reflect the fact that Indigenous people have recognized, you know, judicial and constitutional rights to make decisions regarding their own land. And so whenever there is a conflict that arises because of things like what happened at Gustafson Lake or what happened at Sun Peaks, the media is always on the side of the government. And that is wrong, because they're not going to find any long-term solutions through that process, especially in view of the fact that, in our case, you know, there is legitimate rights for Indigenous people, like there is all across the country, to become self-sufficient, to live in dignity. And the processes of municipalization, of taxing Indians, of control from Ottawa, and the control from Victoria here in British Columbia just is not going to answer the long-term question. So what they're doing is just prolonging the issue by resorting to the use of the police instead of policies, or the use of armed actors instead of renewed policies, and manipulating the media. I think all of those things are have to be addressed here in Canada.
So why is it that the Canadian government can so quickly utilize military force in dealing with natives?
Because there are certain inalienable rights that Indigenous people have to land and to those resources that exist in those lands. And a mediated political process to address these things is impossible on their part. because then that becomes admitting to the wrongs that were done in the past, and to make make amends, then they have to make amends for those crimes. And it's necessary to use this kind of a force also to keep other indigenous people from getting any ideas, if you want to put it in their form of speak, you know, to get any ideas as far as of self-sufficiency and sovereignty are concerned, because it is a threat to Canadian state. You know, like, I'm speaking for myself and for many other Gunyokahaga people who are not Canadian, you know, who are not American, who are not Quebecers or from Ontario, but they are Gunyokahaga people, and they have never relinquished that right to be who they are. And if the Canadian government allows us to be who we are, and then they're beginning to lose their battle, their colonial battle that's going down the tubes, if this is allowed to exist. So we need to use force of arms. Well, the Canadian government needs to use force of arms to keep these people from going astray, to keep the renegades in line, like they did with the cavalry in the plains with the RCMP against any other seditious community who they deem to be seditious and to deem to be anti-colonial. And this is the danger for them. You know, they have to bring us down as hard as they can, so that our resistance doesn't spread to other indigenous peoples.
Arthur, did you want to add anything in there?
Yeah, I think the thing is that when we talk about indigenous rights, and when my friend was talking about inalienable indigenous rights, what we're talking about is our relationship to the land. You know, other organizations, other people, what they call ethnic groups and other things in Canada, they don't have the same relationship that indigenous people have. You know, the only place where we have the right to talk Tsuwabmuk and to deal with the land and in Tsuwabmuk territories in Tsuwabmuk lands, you know, and I think people who immigrate to this country, whether it be 300 years ago or it be just last month, have to respect the rights of the indigenous people, because it's from our land in which, you know, their wealth is generated, and it's us subsidizing Canada that they're really trying to grapple with, because those are fundamental issues that Canadians really don't recognize and respect, is that the whole wealth of this country, everything since the beginning of the colonial period and the formation of Canada and the United States, is based upon indigenous lands, and we're the ones that have been subsidizing this wealth with our freedom, you know, with our dignity and with our self-determination. Those are things that have been subsidizing those things, and that's how come they really get scared when they have to deal with these issues. But Canada will not become a mature and a developed country until it recognizes those things, and I think Canadians have to take the lead by some of the more important, relevant decisions where the courts of this country have said, yeah, Indigenous people do have certain rights, and we have to respect it. I think if we go the way the right wing wants to go, it's not going to solve anything. It's just going to make things worse.
No, I definitely agree with what you said, Arthur. I would like to add also that a big difference between the immigrant cultures that exist here and Indigenous cultures is that our land is not a commodity. You know, it's part of our being. And that's one of the major conflicts that Indigenous people have with Canadian society, is that we will not commodify our territories, at least those righteous people who refuse to do that. And this is part of the problem that Canada has, because we'll not play their game, you know, to commodify and sell our souls for the dollar, you know. And that's where the dilemma lies also, is in that. That's why it's so important for the Canadian government to stymie our culture and to commit ethnocide against us, so that we will start commodifying our land to become just like them.
Going back to the situation we have in Iraq right now, a lot of people frame the case for the Iraqis in terms of self-determination, and that one of the tragedies of this war is that it does rob Iraqi citizens of their self-determination. But of course, that's happening here in Canada. Maybe a question for the both of you is, how do you feel that the relationship between the Canadian state and Indigenous territories across what we call Canada, how has that relationship affected Indigenous self-determination?
Well, it's affected it for the longest time. it has caused divides in the communities, basically convincing those who wish to assimilate that it's a righteous thing to go ahead with the whole program of assimilation to become just a part of. And it's a difficult dilemma that we're in, because basically as indigenous people, we have to try and recognize all the voices that are being spoken in the communities, and some of these voices are calling to become part of Canada or what have you. You know, I don't know, maybe Arthur, maybe you've got a better explanation than I do.
Well, I think one of the things that's very clear is that in Iraq, the whole question there is the United States, you know, in terms of their national security, as they say, is an issue. But one of the things is that, you know, one can recognize that people do have those concerns. But one of the things is that we need to understand that people themselves, indigenous people, people from around the world, also have their own interests. And I think one of the things that's important is to recognize that those choices of self-determination, sovereignty of indigenous people is critical in resolving these issues. And that's one of the things that I think is lacking. I think one of the real problems with North America sort of protruding that our security is more significant than the security of other people around the world is that it does cause problems for ourselves. And part of that problem, though, is the cowboy and Indian type of attitude here in North America. I think if the settlers here in North America, whether they be Canadians or they be Americans or United States people, if they settle the issues fairly with indigenous people, I think they would be able to learn from that experience how to treat people around the world better, you know, and there wouldn't be this repercussion that comes as a threat that they feel they have from foreign countries. Because the thing is that you can't bully your way around the world and expect to be respected, you know. You have to be able to work with people, and you have to learn to compromise, and you need to learn to be able to adjust to the cultures of other people, and I think that's really important. And the thing is that indigenous people in North America, I think, and the treatment by settlers in North America is the real source of that kind of bad foreign policy that's being generated out of North America right now.
It's like the conquistadors. It's the same attitude they have, you know, conquest. The conquest approach to any population, you know, like it's us and them, and it's like we have to conquer them to get our way.
Of course, last year, one of the positive things we saw was that there was, prior to this war, a major worldwide anti-war movement. Again, a question to the both of you. Do you feel that the same people who oppose the war in Iraq would also be ones who would support current indigenous struggles in Canada right now?
I believe that the majority of the ones who are informed and educated on the issues that are occurring is in their own backyard, are willing to listen to it, and then there are some who are willing to stand up against it to help indigenous people acquire those rights. I mean, it'd be pretty hypocritical if activists would just say, well, we're opposed to colonization in Iraq, but not recognize the colonization in the Americas, because it's part and parcel to what's going on in Iraq. It's the same mentality of conquest and of the demonization of their so-called enemies into promoting their capitalist imperial agenda. And it's the same agenda that they had when they so-called conquered the Americas.
I think one of the things is that people really have to question this whole question whether money is the solution to all problems, and the way that the globalization is happening, you know, corporate kind of globalization is being promoted by big industry and governments in many respects. People have to question that, because a lot of the basic values that people take into consideration, like job security, job safety, medical care, health, education, all these different things, these very important values, are being run roughshod over by corporate globalization. People have to start sitting back and saying, what are the real important things that we need to talk about, like the environment, like global warming, these kinds of issues. And I think people that think in those terms think about opposing war as being a solution. The military solution is not the answer. You know, what we need to talk about is we need to talk about how do we stop these global concepts of corporations have to get bigger and bigger, have to consolidate and get larger and larger, and get back to the point of how do we build communities, and how do we build communities that have a responsibility regarding the environment, regarding job security, regarding, you know, energy, regarding healthcare, regarding education, all of these things. You know, people have to really, really think about that. And I think that there is a lot of support out there. I know that in terms of people that opposed the war, there was a large part of the labor movement that showed up here in British Columbia, you know, opposing it, because they see the direct link between their job security and being a big bully in other parts of the world. And the fact that those things don't solve long-term problems, all it does is consolidate wealth, money, power in a very small group of companies and very small group of nation states. And that's not the solution, because money is not the answer. It's the control of the people, of the environment, the land and resources, and their dignity. That's really the question here.
Yeah, they attempt to do the same thing all the time in indigenous communities, to throw money at the problem. You know, like you look at Davis Inlet. You know, well, we spent $150 million to relocate them again, to address their social problems, you know, and obviously the money was not the solution. In more cases than not, the money only furthers the dilemma and the problems in the community, because again, it's like Arthur said, it's vested in the hands of a few. And in the case of indigenous people, it's usually invested in the hands of the politicians in the community, and the bureaucracy gets the king's share of the money, which is the case that's happening in Ganasadaga as we speak. You know, there's no money for healthcare, no money for education, no money for anything else in the community, but there's money for policing, and there's money for propping up a corrupt government in the community that's been bankrupting the community and bankrupting the people in the process. So, you know, the whole money solution is totally distorted and totally corrupting the ability of communities to become healthy. And it relates directly to what the things the anti-war movement were saying. You know, the imperialist agenda and the globalization underneath one flag, you know. It's a continuance of the Monroe Doctrine and Manifest Destiny, you know, on the global scale, which began here in Turtle Island, you know, and it's been brought, exported up to other countries now.
We've been on the phone with Clifton Nicholas in Kanasatake and Arthur Emanuel out in Kamloops. I'd like to thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today.